And I just am constantly amazed. Marilyn, that was beautiful. What a wonderful touch. You can play at my funeral. If you live that long. I don't plan to die anytime soon, because I really believe the Bible is serious when it says that a merry heart doeth the soul good like a medicine. I haven't always had a merry heart, but it has pretty well done my soul good. And I've discovered an interesting thing, which Norman Cousins had to get almost dead in order to discover for himself, that laughter is medicinal. There's something very positive about humor in the human spirit. Norman Cousins wrote a wonderful book called Anatomy of an Illness, in which he described as one of the ingredients of his recovery process fighting a terminal illness to the floor and winning was the fact that he learned that 10 minutes worth of laughter gave him 2 hours totally free of pain. He had gone as far as morphine could take him, and laughter took over. So he watched the Marx Brothers, and he listened to Bill Cosby comedy albums, and he laughed from the gut 10 minutes and got 2 hours free of pain. And I believe that there's something important in laughter. But humor is not always funny. Humor is basically a way to look at life. I come to understand it better, but talking to me about humor is a little bit, I think, like talking to O.J. Simpson about how do you run that way. I can't really tell you how I see that stuff, nor how I do that stuff. I just know it's there, and I love it. Humor is part of life. It's a healthy part of life. Anybody involved in the sciences of human personality and understanding, whether a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a pastoral counselor, just a good friend, knows that someone in the depth of despair, someone whose life has caved in, someone who has experienced some kind of visceral grief, that person begins to show you the evidence of hope the first time that person can laugh again. Laughter is one of the great barometers of the soul. It tells us where we are. If you're not laughing, you're in trouble. If you're laughing all the time, you're in trouble. See, God didn't call us to be giddy, and he didn't call us to look like we're baptized in pickle juice either. And life has some kind of healthy balance. Almost always, the median is the norm. Somewhere between the warp of pain and the woof of ecstasy, we have to learn that life is an incredible blend of all those things. I get asked a lot of questions as a minister who entertains. That's a weird combination. That's like somebody from the desert country that's a snow skier. People don't understand where you learn to do that. But people ask me one very important question, and I think I may have shared it with you before, I'm not sure. Does God have a sense of humor? And I've discovered that people who ask me that are never smiling. Does God have a sense of humor? And they do look like they're baptized in the pickle juice. They do. And I always want to say, and I fight it back, I just want to say so bad, have you looked in the mirror? I want to. Because if God has seen that, we know he laughs. And if God thought that up, he has got a wonderful sense of humor. Because it has certainly tickled me. It's okay for God to think up something like the reproductive process, but not humor? It does make you wonder how some people celebrate life's great moments, doesn't it? That was perfectly delightful, Sylvia. Perhaps we could try that again on our next anniversary, you know, something like that. I think it not strange that the God who created the human heart for hallelujah also created the human heart to hurt. You cannot be sensitive to life at its fullest without getting tickled and without bleeding some. Life is that way. I think one of my biggest problems today, this morning I took off on Brother Oral Roberts a little bit. I don't mind doing that. I can take off on almost any people who are using the media for personal gain in the name of godly glory. Not that all of them are entirely, but some of them are a bunch. And my problem with so many of them, all the way to Jerry Falwell's religious right religiously, all the way back to Bob Shuler's sense of positive Christian thinking, all of which call us to some facets of reality, but none of which is the total gospel. Though I think Shuler gets closer than anybody on television. I discover down that spectrum that people are trying to hold out to us some very false senses of hope. And I'm angry at some of that. And I don't think you can help but be angry at it if you understand what faith is at its deepest roots. People like Jim Baker trying to tell us in front of a bank of powder blue telephones that if you have faith in God, you will never have chiggers. You laugh at that, but people tell me if I have faith in God, I will not have leukemia. Or that if I have faith in God, I will not have cancer. Or that if I have faith in God, my child will not die. That is a lie. Why should I feel that my disease, my trauma, my agony, my pain is a direct result of God's punishment for my sin? Not always true. If you don't think very far from your house, you will discover people you've known in your life who have been absolutely committed to God from the hilt, who've had to bear up under all kinds of agony and pain that was not of their own doing. And down to the one perfect person who ever lived who suffered the most intense agony of all, Jesus of Nazareth on the cross at Calvary, life's most awesome pain, not for anything he did wrong. Who are the people that have taught us the most about life? They're people like Norman Cousins, who in the middle of their agony and their hurt and their pain discovered the splendor of some kind of redemption that came out of their suffering, not because of their suffering. God didn't punish Norman Cousins with an almost terminal illness so he would learn about laughter. But he's discovered some wonderful things in the process. One of your choir members is a longtime good buddy of mine, Judy Ford, and she's sitting down here at the front. And Judy knows a wonderful member of our church in Louisville, the Crescent Hill Baptist Church, named Gaga Woodward, one of our deacons. She is a delight. Gaga lost her home in the tornado that hit Louisville in 74. I, like a fool, the next morning dashed out into the wilderness of despair, which had been ripped up, to see if I could help. Stay out of tornado territories. Leave that to the National Guard and people know what's going on. Don't clog up the highways. But there I was. And a tornado had picked up about a 75-year-old oak tree and moved it across the road into a house. Roots, dirt, and all. Shoom. And it took power lines with it. And they were laying out in the highways. And National Guard had us going another direction. Well, I went around the street and down the street, and there was Gaga Woodward's house half gone. My heart sunk. I'd been in that house just weeks before celebrating the birth of a rhododendron in her backyard. Boop, wonderful. So she had supper. Come over and look at it. And we just, it was great. Rhododendron. Anybody can celebrate rhododendron is wonderful. And cook like that to celebrate it is godly. And I'm just, all right, Gaga Woodward and rhododendron, let's do it. And that house has been clobbered by a tornado. She had a brand new Pontiac Bonneville, 2.5 months old, in her garage, a brick garage. And it had a 1/3 twist in the frame. That's what hit her house. I saw the devastation, and I stopped the car in front of the house, jumped out and said, come on, Eleanor, we got to go. And she said, I just can't do that. Great. I said, come on, Eleanor. She just couldn't face. I said, come on. I drug her in there. She's not wanting to go. We walked in through the dining room wall, which is now in the living room door. And there I stood in the midst of the debris. It had rained after the storm, and it was muck and gunk and everywhere. And I was just horrified. And I heard footsteps upstairs. And I walked the foot of the stairs. You know, Gaga, she said, whoo. Came to the head of the stairs holding a chandelier from the dining room that had gone upstairs. It had not been but 3 months before that that Gaga had been ordained as a deacon. And there she stood holding the chandelier. I didn't know what to say. And she said, Grady, maybe I shouldn't have let them ordain me as a deacon. What do you think? There's some people that believe that she got it for that reason. But like Falwell, they can be wrong where it counts. Well, she put that thing down and came down the stairs and walked into my arms. And I just stood and held her, and I patted her on the back, and she buried her head on my chest bone. Eleanor patted the best she could, didn't know what to say. Gaga finally looked up at me after about a minute of silence. Never shed a tear. Looked me right in the soul, and she said, we'll be okay, Grady. We just lost a house. That wasn't funny. But that was saturated with the obvious fact that that woman wasn't defeated because she lost her dwelling. You got to do more than that to get Gaga Woodward. You'd have to do more than that if you got her physically. This woman ain't going down easy. She's got some spunk. And she will make it. I think that's what God gives us, courage for the struggle, not release from the struggle. It's in the midst of the torment we find it. Humor is a wonderful way to cope. And much of the pain that comes to us can be dealt with if you just get a little ingenious. I find it in wonderful places here and there. I love it when I see people respond with a sense of fun to the nonsense that's going on. Had a minister friend in California who was, well, he was visiting in California at Golden Gate Seminary, and he was getting ready to fly back to St. Louis, and he went out where TWA was going to do its thing again. And he went up to the counter to get his ticket to leave to check in his bag. And he got about 20 feet from the counter, walking up, carrying his bag. And there stood a pinstripe Chicago-type businessman, cigar, absolutely chewing the head off of the ticket agent. What had happened, his flight had been canceled back to Chicago. Wing or a leg had fallen off of the plane or something. And I'm grateful when they cancel one for those reasons. I'm up there a lot, and I want all those wings on that plane. And this fellow was giving it to the agent because the plane had had a mechanical difficulty and couldn't fly. And the next plane's 3 hours away, and this guy's going to miss something. He is livid. Well, the ticket agent was taking it just like they're discussing Mickey Mouse's ears. You know, it's no big deal. And he was so cool and comfortable. And the guy would say, I'm going to sue the company. So I'll be glad to give you the president's name, sir. You can write him right here. And he turns that around. And the guy could not fluster our ticket agent. And he bombed him and he cussed him and he fumed. Much of what this minister heard, he had never heard before. But he knew it was cussing. Somehow cussing just stands on its own. And he was just parting his hair with it from 20 feet away. And the ticket agent continued to take it in good stride. Continued to say, sir, I can understand your feelings. I probably feel the same way. I can just da-da-da-da. And this guy, and he'd say, yes, sir, I can certainly understand it. Well, the guy couldn't hurt him because the guy just kept dodging all the time. And he was furious. Finally, he snatched up his ticket and let him have another couple of volleys. Stormed off across the area, going in the lounge so he can fuel for the next trip. Ticket agent took the man's bag and put it on the canvas conveyor belt, wadded up the carbon off the ticket, threw it in the trash, moved the ballpoint over here and looked up at my minister friend and said, yes, can I help you? And this guy stared at him. He said, how do you do that? And the guy said, what do you mean? He said, that guy just backed up and dumped on you. And you're just standing here, fa-la-la-la-la. I don't see. He said, well, he had a right to be upset. Yeah, but he didn't have a right to treat you that way. Yeah, but he was rightfully, you know, it's just. He said, yeah, but you handle it so cool. How do you do that? And he said, well, you just develop ways to deal with people. Folks act like that. You just accept it. He didn't mean it personal. He said, yeah, but I couldn't do that. Ticket agent said, well, you find your ways. He said, such as. Ticket agent looked around, leaned over, and said, I just sent his bag to Tokyo. Isn't that wonderful? I just love it. Part of the great gift of humor is the ability to take those moments. As one of the ads says, you know, take life's lemons and make lemonade. Take the pain that comes to you and turn it into something productive. Take the struggle that's yours. Learn to move it ahead. I think that's one of the great gifts that God gives us. There's got to have a sense of humor, sure. If God didn't have a sense of humor, there wouldn't be any Baptists. We all know that. We're the strangest thing he's done since the aardvark. We do crazy things. You know, we build churches like this one, put steeples out here, and most of our Baptist churches wouldn't put a cross up there for anything in the world. Fight over it. Argue over it. In fact, we had fiery letters came into the Western Recorder here last spring sometime because, see, one of the guys ran an ad for crucifixes or something. You know, crosses. That just bent them out of shape. Most of our churches won't put a cross up there. They don't want anybody passing through town to look up and think the Catholics are doing all that good. See, we don't want to do that. Usually do something a little more Baptist, something a little more in keeping with our basic stand on tough issues. We have a chicken facing away from the wind. You know, we'll do something. Baptists generally say it may be in the Bible, but we didn't vote on it. You know. Now, I like being part of a group where nobody can tell me what to do. I like that. And I think it's important that you learn to keep those things in perspective. There are wonderful gifts that come to us. I like the free church tradition where we can kind of do it our own style. I would not want to live in a subdivision where somebody not only made my house look the same but decorated it alike. I don't always like blue. And I like to be around the place where you can express yourself. I think it's wonderful for one church that loves power into blood and the other one to love joyful, joyful, we adore thee. That's fine. And I think it's good to have that kind of diversity, and I think it's important to cultivate it. I just don't want anybody voting for me. I want to vote for myself. And I think God gives us that wonderful kind of diversity. Churches are kind of fun. One of the sad things to me is that far too many of us have decided that humor has no place in church. We've decided that it belongs on the porch. My mother felt that way. Mother's the funniest person you nearly ever met. She's crazy. Fruit Loops. Just goofy, wonderful, till she gets to church. My mother comes in the back door and looks like she's been hairsprayed with holy, you know, just. She is so funny, because I know what she's sitting there thinking. Outside, she's sweet our prayer. Inside, she's ta-ra-ra-boom-dee. This woman is that way. I remember one Sunday I'd gone up to sing for my dad. He was pastor of the New Hope Baptist Church. Mother called it No Hope. And I think they called him his pastor because she was a good pianist. And they went up to be at this little church, and my mother is some kind of piano player. Now, she would have just enjoyed this so much tonight, could probably turn around and almost do that back to you, as long as she could hear it. Now, if you put it on paper, she's a little nervous. In hardback, she just cannot play it. Paperback, she does pretty good. Mother taught herself not only to play by ear, but taught herself to read music, and by the time she was 14, could play virtually anything you put in front of her, never had a lesson. Just an incredible musician. I had a sister who could do that when she was 12, and the first key she played by ear was F sharp. You got to be strange to do that. People that love music hate F sharp. I mean, that's not fun. Well, Mother was that kind of piano player, and Dad wanted me to come up and sing a special in their little church. Well, a lot of you know the difference between a special and a solo. Solo means you have a printed bulletin. Special means they can call on you anytime they want to. Same thing, but solo, you got time to get nervous. Special, you just never know. Dad just say, come sing. Woo, you got to do it. See? Well, I was kind of excited about it because I'd been away studying voice for a year with Dr. Shelby Collier at Wayland Baptist College in Plainview, Texas. And I was kind of excited for this little church. I'm going to go up and sing for them. And I felt fairly confident they had never heard a really trained voice. And it was hard to be humble when you knew what they were about to experience. So I came to do my special. Mom came to the pen, and I walked over after they had took 12 minutes to introduce me. A few tears, his son Grady home from college and all that stuff. And, I went over and stood by the piano, and I was really excited. The song was a wonderful old tune called Ere You Left Your Room This Morning, Did You Think to Pray? Many of you remember that. Ere you left your room this morning. And I love the way they list hymns in the hymn book. You ever notice in little old hymn books, it's so much fun. If it's the title of the song, they give it to you in all capital letters. This one would be, Did You Think to Pray? All capital letters. Did you think to pray? Question mark. 43. That's how they would do it. But if you couldn't remember the title, but you could remember, Ere You Left Your Room This Morning, they'd put an E in there and little lowercase letters, Ere You Left Your Room This Morning, and they'd give you all that they could before they had to go 43. And I'd just open up the hymn book every night and rummage through there. And I got tickled at that one time because in the back of the old modern hymn book, it's absolutely true. Paperback, chocolate brown, black letters. It says in that deal, Ere you left your room this morning, did you think to? ...43. So I believe I did, you know. Yeah, you know, sure. Well, I came over, Mom's going to play for me, and I stood there just like Shelby Collier had taught me to stand. I got my feet in line with my armpits. Got one slightly in front of the other one so you could step forward and backward and shift your weight and not lock your knees up on a high note and faint. Held my hands at my waist so they'd know it memorized. Then sang with what we called a covered tone. That's when you kind of mush it up a little, aim it at the front of your nose, and it comes, kind of like that. See, I grew up in Texas, and we sang God, and they wanted you to sing God, kind of replace it. I didn't think God sounded so bad. They wanted God up that well, so I could do that. So you come out, and it was kind of interesting for an audience, too, because you'd come out and sing for him, you know, God so loved the world, just really dark it up. The rule was, if you could understand it, it was wrong, you know. And you'd sing like that, God unto thee most holy, kind of like that. And then people would come by after you finished and tell you how well you did. And you'd say, thank you very much, and they'd stare at you. Well, I sang that song, finished one octave up. And Mom, boy, and the church was just ecstatic, you know, they were. Wanted to clap, but they weren't as freed up as y'all. And they just sat there. The way they did it was well, those little funeral home fans. That's good. You know, they'd just go for it. I think air conditioning has cheated this generation out of something thrilling. Don't you miss the old funeral fans? That was just kind of fun, you know, sit there and get your air when you want it. That was so neat. Came different styles, but the general deal was about the same. Little front on it about like that with a picture, usually one of two pictures. Either Jesus was kneeling by a big moonbeam wearing a velvet robe, and he was poor, looking up a moonbeam. He was a blonde, blue-eyed Jew with a permanent. You ever know? Didn't know Jesus was from Norway. You know, it was just kind of interesting. The other picture, he was standing beside a door that had big hinges and no knob on it. He had a sheep on his shoulder and a sad look on his face. And those were the two pictures we always had on the front of the funeral home fans. On the back was the name of the funeral home, Thompson's Funeral Home, and under it would be their message, see us. Florida to Texas, I found one that said, we can wait. True say. And Ann, you told me one about the funeral home fan, and on the back it said, conveniently located 6 blocks from the New Baptist Hospital. Just makes you have cold willies, doesn't it? had different kinds of handles on them. One was kind of a twisted grocery paper sack stapled on once. I don't know who they thought was really going to use that. That's decorative. That's not helpful. You get into church and the preacher gets a little close to what you've been up to. You grab that thing and go for air and it'll just... You know, you can't get air with that thing. Only way you're going to get air is get close to your French cuff. You know, that's about it. You know, just. Then I had one that the Pentecostal churches used a lot. This one had a doctor's tongue blade stapled on twice with industrial staples. Had ripples down both sides. You grab it left-handed, right-handed, it didn't matter. Pentecostal people, when they need air, they ain't got time to see which way the fan's facing. You know, they got to do it. Had one that folded up. It would go in a coat pocket or a purse, folded down like a fan, opened out. There was your picture, see us on the back. I love that because you could fold it and there was a little brass grommet at the bottom with a hole in it about the diameter of a pencil eraser. During a prayer, you could turn it up and peek through that hole and do all kinds of stuff. That's got to help. Then the Methodists used one that had a hole in the bottom about that big around, about the size of a 50-cent piece, and it was reinforced with glued-on cardboard so you wouldn't snag an organdy glove. And you put your thumb through that and cup your hand and just kind of do this. See, it's really kind of decorative. Methodists rarely ever get enough for preaching to really sweat through. You know, just kind of just... Catholics have an interesting funeral home fan. It's square, and on one side it says, Bingo. Well, people showered down on those little fans. Mom and I went over and took our seat. Here's my mom, you know, just so dedicated. Dad got ready to preach, and we sat on those old homemade church pews. That's one of my favorite things about the little country church was the homemade pews. They all had their unique characteristics, but they're very similar. Had solid end supports and a brace in the middle, and then between them, the seat and the back were made out of occasional flexible 1x2s. And between the 1x2s, you're on your own. Had a lot of give to them. You know, you just kind of sit there and... Had to watch it if you're sitting on the same pew across the center divider from the church heavy lady, Ms. Hawkins. It's a dear lady, but she had serious problems. Couldn't cross her legs, just her ankles. And couldn't get her hose all the way up. Stopped under the knee and kind of went around and had a big knot on the outside tucked under. That's true, man. It looked like she's smuggling sausage. That's what it looked like. Wondered about those ladies in pantyhose. I thought about that. That's got to be a problem when that's the way you've worn your hose all your life, and then they came out with pantyhose. Used to you just pull up one leg at a time. Now you got them both in a group, see? And I wonder, did they just roll them on their knees and hobble everywhere? Wouldn't that be kind of strange? Pantyhose made it tough on a lot of people. Bank robbers. You know, bank robber used to pull on one nylon, go in and get his money, right? You know, just give me your money, that mashed up face and everything. Now you go in trailing a spare leg and they laugh at you. And you can't get any money trailing a spare leg. You can't do that. What you could do is get a friend to wear the other leg. Rob two windows at once, that'd be good. You're running for your car, be sure you both stay on the same side of the light poles. Wow, that'd be kind of weird. Well, Mom and I sit down on these old pews, and you had to watch Miss Hawkins. That's the point I'm making here. Miss Hawkins, at some point during the service, would shift herself around. And you had to be ready, because when she did, your end of the pew would all go, woohoo! It would do it every time. Well, Mom and I are sitting there. Dad gets up to preach that morning. Dad was a 6'5", 310 pounds of truth on the loose. Dad had an eighth grade education with a D average and quit at Christmas. But as most of you are aware, Baptists will ordain anything willing. Baptist church, you want to, you get to. Methodist church, they make you go to school and learn it wrong. But Baptist church, they let it get you wrong on your own. You know, you can just handle it. Well, my dad gets up to preach. He's got his big Bible in his arm with his finger in it just in case he gets to the text. Dad's main gift was volume, and today he was preaching another in a series of sermons. He loved to preach series. This series was from the book of Exodus. He'd started the series in the month of October. This is June. He's in chapter 2. And verse 3. Today, Dad's dealing with the symbolism of the heifer. Dad loved symbolism. He thought numbers in the Bible were symbolic. You know, mark of the beast in Revelation 6:66. Dad knew about that. Understood it. Could explain it. It was really interesting to watch how these numbers work. 5 would be the word for peace, and 16 was the number for love. 9 was repentance, and Dad knew all these numbers, what they meant. People just turned the Bible sideways and right on the edges. That's good stuff, you know. That's what a scholar. You can get on the radio with that stuff. You know, people mail money to it. It's incredible. And Dad believed in symbolism. And he could really get you when he got rolling. He'd say, you know, he could mix it up some. He'd take chapter 2 and verse 3. That's 5. And 4 horns from the goat in the book of Daniel. That's 9, and that means repent. People said, what a scholar. What a scholar. What a scholar. You know, just... start you a college. Well, anyhow, Dad was just really letting us have it today about the heifer, and he's explaining to us this special sacrifice that had to take place. Between the feast of the preparation and the Passover was 21 days, and during that time, if anybody goofed after they got started into the holy high days, they had to kill a heifer to make up for it, see? And so if you goof, you got to go to the priest and admit that you coveted or something. Priest says, you what? I coveted. You know, it's bad. You got to admit a covet. It's tough. So they kill a heifer. Now, the heifers are not dumb. See, they grow up behind the temple, and they're used to seeing their friends being led off. They hear a big whack and see a poof of smoke, and they never come back. They know. They know. So the priest goes out, and they get a heifer, and they lead her out and kill her, catch her blood in the basin. And then, according to the ritual, he has to take a weed called a hyssop, kind of a broom weed stuff, but a hyssop, H-Y-S-S-O-P. Now, my dad only had the 8th grade education. He called it hyssop. And he kept talking about hyssop. Well, he'd say hyssop, hyssop, and Mom and I are sitting on the front row just on the other side of the gladiolas. And Dad would go, hyssop. Well, I'm just fighting it back. You know. See, I've had a year in Baptist college. Mom finished high school. We both knew it was hyssop. Dad would hyssop and hyssop, and Mom and I are over here. Well, now, she's got her face at church, but inside she's at the circus, see. And Dad would go, hyssop, I'm fighting it back, and she won't give me an elbow. Please, Mom, don't do this. And all through his sermon that day, hyssop, hyssop, she'd, oh, I don't, Mother, please, I'm dying. Well, he comes to the apex of the sermon, and he keeps getting louder and louder and louder. Hyssop, 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 and he's just getting... And he came to the pinnacle of the sermon, and I'm already just on the cliff edge of frenzy. You know, oh, don't, one more time, I'm gone. Dad showered down harder than he's ever preached in his life. Ta-da, ta-da, and at the apex of the sermon got 2 words crisscrossed. My father ordained to the one and only true Baptist gospel. Came out with the filthiest words you have ever heard. It would have been bad enough if he yelled it, but he preached it. Well, people ate those little funeral home fans 2 staples deep. You know, just couldn't believe it. Weren't but 80 people there, but they all hunkered. You can hear more than 4 people hunker. You know. And you would think that a man ordained to the Baptist ministry wouldn't even know what that word meant, but you could tell by looking, he did. You know, just, he knew what he'd done. And the whole church is, And Mom and I have been high-sopping for 10 minutes down here. And the minute he went, da-da, both of us just, lost. Only two people left, his wife, his son. He made us go home on the Greyhound. He was just real upset. I mentioned my church in Louisville, which I love dearly, and our new young minister, Steve Shoemaker, is a wonderful, wonderful, gifted minister, and we love him to death. Sunday 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago now, Sam Weekly, one of our deacons in the church, came forward to lead the offertory prayer. Sam grew up near Buffalo Lick, which is over close to Christiansburg and Baghdad. Sam wanted to be a veterinarian. He couldn't get in veterinary school, so he went to medical school and became a surgeon. And makes me nervous when he goes to work on me and I have to paw the table first. I don't know why he wants me to do that. Sam has a wonderful route to way, both of talking, acting, and doing his deal. He's comfortable. He's easy. I love him dearly. And Sam came forward in a church which is very much like yours in tone and worship. The attitude is one that's comfortable. The music is lofty. The feeling is splendid. We take it very seriously when I do our deal there. And Sam came up. We just finished a beautiful hymn, and he walks up to the platform and leads the offertory prayer. And it was very much a route to kind of prayer. He thanked God for this beautiful day, and it was just kind of twanging through old Sam's nose. And he finished up. Amen. Everybody just thought, that's so good. We sat down. Choir came up and did an anthem. The difference between an anthem and a hymn, do you know that? A hymn says the cow jumped over the fence and ran away. That's a hymn. The anthem says the cow, my black and white Holstein cow. My cow. Jump it, did jump it, the cow did jump it over, I cow, my black and white cow did jump it over the holy fence and ran, the cow did jump it, oh, the fence did round it. That's an anthem. See, that's the difference. And our choir had done this wonderful anthem, and it was elegant and wonderful. And the church was just kind of sitting here like a gem ready to be mounted at the moment in a beautiful mounting of some kind. It was just a splendid deal. Facets were already glistening, and everything was perfect. And Steve Shoemaker, our young minister, comes to the podium to preach. And he looked down, and this just blank expression went over his face. He looked to the left and to the right on the platform and on the pulpit, and then he looked over to minister of music, and he looked around to the minister of education, walked back down to the seat where he'd been seated and looked on the floor and walked back up to the, and we're all saying, what's wrong? And he put his elbow down on the pulpit and looked right down at Sam Weekly on the front row, and he said, Sam, somebody got my sermon. Sam Weekly, when he picked up his prayer, just walked off with Steve's sermon. Sam got tickled, and the church applauded as Sam came up and handed Steve his sermon for the morning. Went back and sat down in the midst of all that laughter. Steve caught his breath. He said, Sam, for 5 minutes you had my brains in your hands. We laughed again. We caught our breath, and in one stride, Steve Shoemaker was back on target in a church that was ready to worship. I took that as rather a strong parable of what it means to bring your best, your honest, your good self to church. The ability to get tickled when it's appropriate. The ability to weep when it's appropriate. The ability to hug one another. The ability to know when to keep our distance. The ability to be ourselves. God has given us no better gift than the ability of appropriate emotion at a time of worship. That's why I think it is so crucial for us to be able to move through the paces and the patterns of the church with all that we are and all we can be, and to learn to celebrate it just that way. In the Bible, we basically celebrated our times of worship. And that meant we brought all that good stuff with us. And I think it's important to baptize our humor just like our wallets when we come to church with our good gifts, and to be able to share that in the true spirit of who He is. I think one of the things missing in our country today is an authentic sense of humor. I think we lost a lot of it with Nixon. Because he was so pompous and royal about himself, he wanted those little foreign-dressed characters standing outside the door like wooden soldiers to open limousine doors. And then he took us through Watergate, and we discovered that presidents can also be selfish and sometimes dishonest. We didn't like that. And somehow we begin to slip and slide, and it's not just the economy that's gotten to us, but it's our lack of hope in leaders and our trust in some people. And so humor has kind of gone down the tube. I've begun to realize again and afresh that these are the days when someone like Will Rogers loose in the country really needs to tickle us again, to get us laughing from the inside instead of at the outside, to quit finding our joy in the stuff we can use with ethnic slurs, begin once more to laugh joyfully because of a sense of real hope. We're short on that today, and I think it definitely needs to float back to the surface. I think a lot of the truth that God gives us comes to us from all around us, and sometimes we're too blind to see it. I found it in a hymn, which really isn't in the hymn book, and it's not even in the Psalms, but it becomes a hymn to you when you understand it, written by Joan Baez in the 60s, called Tumbleweed. It says, "Feel like an old lonesome tumbleweed rolling across the western plains." And gosh, I've watched them do that all my life. Tumbleweed's a Texas state bird. Tumbleweeds just live their lives hoping they'll die and blow to Oklahoma. That's where they want to go. Where they deserve to go. But I feel like an old lonesome tumbleweed rolling across the western plains. I've seen them do that. Here's the part you need to hear in italics. "Once I pulled all my roots free, I became a slave to the wind." Whole lot of difference between freedom and being a slave to the winds of circumstance. Whole lot of difference between hanging on deeply to the stuff that really matters, like Gaga Woodward, and say, in the face of the worst wind possible, we only lost a house. Hanging on with roots that a tornado couldn't blow free. That's what I think makes a difference in people. And I mentioned that to the young man I think is the finest preacher in the country today, named Paul Duke. Paul is one of my closest friends. He's minister of the Highland Baptist Church now in Louisville. And I told Paul that about a year ago. And he thought about it for a little bit, and he said, "You know, it reminds me of an astronaut." And I said, "How?" He said, "Well, an astronaut gets outside the capsule attached by the umbilical cord and moves around weightlessly in space." And I've always thought that'd be fun. And he said, "So long as the astronaut is attached by the umbilical cord, he is free. When it gets severed, he is independent." I think somehow we're close to forgetting that. And I believe people who have their roots deep in the stuff of God, people who have committed themselves in faithful obedience to his difficult will, people who, like Dietrich Bonhoeffer in the midst of prison, found a joy that Hitler couldn't snuff out with a rope, people who in the midst of life's great turmoil, like Job, could sit there and stare tormentors in the face and say, "I've done nothing to deserve this, and it will not keep me from praising God in the midst of my boils and my sores." Or to stare in the face of a person for whom life has been nothing but avalanche after avalanche and find them searching through all the rocks in the pile for nuggets. Those are the kind of folks that make a difference. That's why Jim Baker's crowd makes me a little antsy. They keep trying to tell me if I love God, there wouldn't be avalanches. I say, if you love God, you hunt for nuggets in the piles. It seems to me that God gives us that kind of hope if we remain attached to the things that give us strength and his kind of freedom. And it was Jesus of Nazareth who with his very life said, "If you know the truth will make you free. It'll also make you nervous. Sometimes it'll make you angry. Sometimes it'll make you just struggle, but in so doing it makes you free." And I want that kind of freedom for myself. I want that kind of freedom for the church. That's why I'm glad to be part of a church that allows me freedom to be myself. Does not try to force me into a mold like Jell-O, but allows me to celebrate my uniqueness and to discover that I was not meant to be part of a melting pot, but part of a patchwork quilt, where I can put my stripes by your polka dots and we can celebrate being on the same blanket. I think that's wonderful. And God gives us that kind of uniqueness as he creates us to be who we are. I want to be part of a church that understands that and understands its world and seeks to give itself away. If you can be that kind of church, your joy will become contagious. And it will become the kind of contagion that the best understanding of the New Testament calls evangelism. Reaching out to others for joy. and they come to us out of celebration, and together we become his people, and our journey becomes his pilgrimage. I think that's what he calls us to be.